Thank you very much, Dylan, for inviting me to come along and poison your poetic chalice. I actually write prose. So I'm going to tell you a few stories. And the first one is probably the shortest thing I've ever written. It's a standalone piece. And then I'm going to do a few little snippets from two different novels. Okay. The first thing, which is a standalone piece, is called The Ingenuity of Prolonging a Dog's Life. Years and years ago, the new puppy arrived in a brown paper bag. My uncle took a look at the shivering little white creature. Uncle Tom was unimaginably young then, not yet a qualified priest, but he baptised the puppy El Señor Muggs Gagan anyway. There had been much discussion of the Spanish Civil War in the household at that time. The puppy was Muggs, for short, but ever the diplomat, he also answered to the name of Cozy when my grandmother called him. Many decades later, my mother and I came across Muggs at the hospital museum. The dear old dog had become twin greyhounds, connected by a tangle of translucent tubes to a large machine humming electronically in its white case. For a moment, I thought they might be just ordinary stuffed greyhounds, but then I saw their eyes move. One Muggs inclined his head towards a passing museum guard, as though he suspected he'd be fed. I wondered, could dogs this ancient still gnaw bones? Or did they, like astronauts, survive on puree squelched out from sterile silver packets? The Muggs' knuckles were held together with masking tape, peculiarly amateur when you consider the remarkable achievement of their being duplicated, enlarged, and kept alive for all these years. Had they developed a tendency to catch their paws in slamming doors or other narrow crevices? One can become clumsy with age. Two women in white coats, pockets ranged with pens and thermometers, fussed with the dials on the Muggs' machine. My mother holds back, peeping round the doorway. Obviously, Muggs was a lot smaller when she last saw him, over 50 years earlier, and there was only one of him then. Muggs' mother was a Pomeranian, and his father was always believed to have had some terrier in him. Yet, Muggs' bones may have lengthened and doubled, but that white fur was the same. Those great canine eyes looked at us with the same near-tragic adoration that I'd seen in my grandmother's many photos of him. It was most emphatic now, what with Muggs having two sets of eyes. If my mother were not so dazed, she might have made some laborious joke about things being stereo or the like. I tell her to approach them. He'll recognise you. It will be wonderful. She lingers at the door. I speak to the museum guards or laboratory assistants, whatever they are, and I explain that these dogs were once my mother's. Sure enough, the brass-rimmed plaque on the dog's display cabinet reads Garvey, which was my grandmother's surname before she married Dr. Cusack, a coroner. After Grandma died, she went to a laboratory. It was intended as a helpful gesture to the medical students at UCD. She was in there for 12 weeks or so before going to ground in an ordinary coffin. The women in white coats seem unimpressed by our family connection to their exhibit. I tried to find out how Muggs came to be there, who presented him to the museum, and so on. The women refer vaguely to an ambulance with a flat tyre. I point to my mother, still standing by the door. She's not usually so shy. I assume she's overwhelmed with happiness at seeing Muggs again. I wave at her and ask her to come over. One Muggs sits upright. The other reclines, sphinx-like. Which is the clone? Do the Muggses know which of them is the clone? Their eyes water when they see her. The nearer of the two moves stiffly, lowering his long muzzle. The other drops his jaw and pants, slow motion, pink tongue heaving up and down. They know who she is. My mother approaches, but she cannot pet either of the Muggses' heads as the glass separates them. We all four stare at each other for a whole futile three-quarter hour before my mother starts to fret about her parking ticket expiring. We leave the museum, quietly impressed with the advanced cardiopalliative interventions, cloning, cryogenics, DNA modification and taxidermy techniques that have made Muggs into two greyhounds on a life support machine in a display cabinet of walnut wood. Will my mother want the same procedure when she's nearing death? It would be odd to visit her in the hospital museum. I don't think she'd want a clone, however. I wouldn't know whether to bring grapes or a wreath. And I'm going to read a couple of snippets from a novel that I'm just finishing at the moment. And it's still on the hospital theme, actually. The novel's called Lord Blister. And the little bit I'm going to read you, it's 1954. Harry Bannister's family have locked him up in a psychiatric hospital in the hope of curing his homosexuality. And his employer and lover, Lionel, comes very tentatively to visit. He's also afraid of being locked up.
Sorry, the door's used, so... But there's
Sorry.
A seat by Bill.
It's okay, I'll just...
Sorry.
Okay. That Sunday, a Morris Minor brushed up the dead leaves along the 9-foot wall enclosing the Royal Victoria Hospital. Wearing a flat cap and clutching at his gammy left knee, Lionel manoeuvred himself out of the passenger seat. "Wait a bit further along, but not too far," Lionel ordered his driver, a much younger man, also wearing a flat cap. "Pop this piece of crap where I can still varder it and get there pronto if I has to." Lionel stuffed his kid gloves into the pocket of his donkey jacket, took off his diamond ring, and rubbed his bare hands together as he approached the hospital gates. "I'm here to see me nephew, Harold Bannister," he croaked up at the man in the wooden box. "Me wife would have come too, but she's had an awful time with her nerves. Ever so distressing, him turning out the way he has. He seems so normal." "Ward?" asked the man in the wooden box, his finger ready to jab the telephone. "4. Name?" "I'm Jack Jones," announced Lionel. "Nah, patient's name," the man in the box said, not bothering to look down. Sorry, mate, thought I told you. Harold Bannister. Bannister. Sorry." The man in the box sat pursing his lips, the receiver pressed to his ear, and eventually told whoever picked up that there was a visitor for a Bangister on Ward 4. Harry gawped at the character led up to him. Behind the nurse's back, Lionel's eyes did a frantic dance and his forefinger was pressed to his lips. Lionel wore the shabbiest clothes imaginable, hideously workaday shoes that were at least 2 sizes too large. Harry wondered whether Lionel had lost his marbles. "Thank you, nurse. Yes, this is me nephew. Me half-sister's kid, God rest her soul. Me and his aunt's ever so grateful for what you're doing to him. Yes, he's looking better already. Ain't modern medicine marvellous?" "Get up and say hello to your visitor then, Bannister," smirked the nurse. "All the way from Epping. Didn't know your lot got around so much." Harry stood shakily, holding out his hand. Lionel did not take it, but stood with his hands firmly planted on his hips. "So what have you got to say for yourself, eh?" Lionel squawked in his peculiar new voice. "Eh? Causing all this bother? Your poor dad's worn to a shred, worrying. Worn to a shred, and after all what he done for you." The nurse folded his arms on the curved summit of his belly and watched the visitor approvingly. They sat in the tiny side room, and Harry laid a hand on the table, willing Lionel to touch it. The door was closed, after all. "You bleeding Michiganer," Lionel whispered, not without tenderness. "I had to get kicked out down the Sally Army for this." Harry's laugh choked him. "You came," he blurted. "I thought you never would. It's been nearly a week since I telephoned. Come here." He put out his arms. "Shh, nurses might come in." Lionel looked down. "I was shocked, you know. Of course, I'm dreadful sorry for you." "They won't let me out. It's disgusting in here now, but it's like they got the right to tell me how to be. Like there's something really badly wrong." "Harry," Lionel finally met his lover's eyes. "This is the world, and being HP don't go down well. There's only polonies what spend months in the nick just for being like us. Sometimes you act a bit reckless, remembers me saying? About you being too physical in public?" "Yeah," Harry folded his arms tightly. "And I'm sure you don't like it here, but come on, play the game. Just tell him you don't know what came over you. You ain't mentioned me, have you?" "It ain't fair, Nelly, none of it." Harry told Lionel everything that happened since he'd been in hospital. Lionel hummed and tutted, smoked copious cigarettes, examined his nails, and shifted in his seat. "Did you bring me anything to read?" Harry remembered to ask, just as Lionel began looking at his watch. Lionel's thread-like eyebrows vanished under his flat cap. "Dear boy, the sort of books you go for ain't going to be no good to you in here. Not unless you want to convince them all you're a raving HP beyond all hope of redemption. You're from the unwashed mashes, remember? Feelies like you don't read no proper books, not less than Nancy boys. Nah, you wants to be ogling pictures of Betty Page and her ilk. I'll post you some if you like. Dr. Bunrattle's always given me loads, Harry said glumly. I'm supposed to stare at her every evening. It's to modify my psychosexual perceptive responses or something. Lionel put his hand over his mouth. It's not funny now. Nah, of course not. You're stuck in this nice warm gaff. Free up dinners, a wireless, not a stitch of work to do, and pin-up girls to ogle. Why don't you bleed and pretend to like it? Prove I'm wrong. At least you ain't in no military prison. I can tell you that ain't no picnic. Harry raised his head. You were in prison? Yeah, it was horrible. Worse than the fighting in some ways. They stuck me in there because they said I was damaging morale. Got me out of the WAPS line of fire, that's all I can say. Lionel shivered. Ever so bleeding lonely it was, but at least I weren't no deserter. How did you get out? Served me time, kept myself to myself. I mean, I was on my own a lot anyway, being solitary. But I never even smiled at the Sharpies, in case they thought I was giving them the eye. You got it easy here, you know. They ain't even give you them Brewer's Troop pills, like what Franco had to take. Horrible they were, ruined his physique. All you has to do, Harry, is talk to your Dr. Bumrattle, ha-ha, if you can keep a straight face. Huh, yeah, straight face, that's it. Lionel put on his uncle voice again. Yes, Doc, no, Doc, thanks very much. Of course I like girls, really, Doc. Out you come. What if I can't do it? Harry's voice trembled. What do you mean, can't bloom do it? Hissed Lionel. Of course I make stuff up, Nell, and there's plenty I keep shtum about, like we all do. Whether they believe me or not's another story. But you tell me why they're bleeding out I should go along with all this crap when I ain't done nothing wrong, Nell, nothing. Why should I be ashamed? We never hurt no one. Don't tell me to shush. Lionel huffed and folded his arms. He leant back in his chair for a moment, then leant forward again, gripping Harry's knee. Listen, Feely, you don't want to end up in here for years. Now you swallow that cheek, you act the full-on straight lad till they believes you. Tell him you can't bleed and stand, queers. Come out, get yourself a beard, you know, get pally with a girl, get her up the duff even. Sure you'd make some lucky donner a wonderful husband, right? He patted Harry's knee before getting up to go.
Thank you.